I'm Arun Venugopal, and we've got one more story to round out the hour here on The Takeaway. Filmmaker Taika Waititi frequently pops up on screen in the movies he writes and directs, usually playing an endearingly goofy character, whether it's a nearly 400-year-old vampire in What We Do in the Shadows.
So it's 6 p.m. in the nighttime, which is when I wake up. This is always a really scary part for me.
Or a friendly alien in Thor Ragnarok.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Korg. I'm kind of like the leader in here. I'm made of rocks, as you can see, but don't let that intimidate you. You don't need to be afraid unless you're made of scissors. Just a little rock, paper, scissor joke for you.
When I sat down with him recently, he brought some of that same energy into the studio. Taika Waititi, I'm sorry?
Sorry, what?
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I was just going to introduce you. No. But I don't have to.
Is this the intro?
It's unnecessary.
I'm not going to introduce you.
Just go straight into it.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah, do that
Taika
first.
Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Taika Waititi is the writer, director, and star
of Jojo Rabbit.
But Jojo Rabbit represents a bit of a departure for him. It's a satire set in Nazi Germany, and the main character, Jojo, is a 10-year-old member of the Hitler Youth. The role that Taika has given to himself this time around is Jojo's imaginary friend, Adolf Hitler.
He's conjured from the mind of a 10-year-old boy, so he can only know what a 10-year-old boy knows. So he's an idiot, and I think that's why you can actually bear to have him in these scenes. If we had gone with an actual real actor, someone who could act and was proud of it, I think they'd put too much effort in. I think they would have researched Hitler. I think they would have studied him. And I think that he doesn't deserve that. I think that gives him too much power.
Using humor to talk about the Nazis, even when it's being used to take them down, is a risky approach. But the work seems to have connected. Taika won Best Adapted Screenplay from the Writers Guild of America and the BAFTAs over the weekend. Up next are the Oscars, where the film is nominated for 6 awards, including Best Picture. And while Taika acknowledges the sensitivity of the subject matter, he says his goal was not to make a provocative movie.
I have no idea how to make a drama. I mean, that's the reason I try to do it in my own style. And if you look at my other films, tonally, they all have that balance. You know, it skirts the line between comedy and drama, and it comes backwards and forwards, and it doesn't lead the audience by the hand and set them up for the dramatic parts by easing them into it for 10 minutes of the film. Sometimes it's just like that, you know, and it just happens, boom. And it's a surprise for people. And I feel like that's truer to life. I think the mixture of comedy and drama is the human experience. That's what life is. That's what every day is like for every single person. You know, you go between laughing and crying and fury and rage and jealousy and then back to love and then back to hate. And that's who we are. And I love seeing that mixture in films. And as for comedy and using comedy with the subject matter, it's always been a really effective tool for dealing with bullies and with ideologies that threaten to ruin humanity, I guess. And look, I really think that a lot of the great dramatic films about the Holocaust and about World War II, they have their place in the history of this topic, and they're extremely important, and I think we all know the films. Personally, that's not the way that I feel like I can approach a film like that, because I don't know if I really have the emotional tools to be able to just do a drama. But I will say that when people assume, and a lot of the critics I think of this film haven't seen the film, which I've come to learn, is that people will criticize the film because they've assumed a certain thing about it, that we're using jokes and making Nazis funny, which is not what's happening in the film at all, if you see the film. What we're doing is trying to pick away the threads at a regime and at a way of thinking, and really just focusing in on the ridiculousness of this kind of stuff, of bigotry and basically focusing on the ridiculousness of racism, which is, when you step back from it, it is a preposterous idea. It's ludicrous and it's absurd. And so part of what we do is, you know, when you look at things like I think in a lot of dramas about this time, the Nazis are painted as this sort of elite, most organized, efficient. I mean, they're almost like the Empire in Star Wars, you know, like everything's always perfect and there's something to be feared. I think the issue with that is, and yes, they, you know, were bullies and they were calculating and they were responsible for millions of people dying. But I think personally, if we continue to do that and paint them this way, then we continue to fear them. And I don't want to do that. I want to laugh at them. I want to take the power away from them. And by focusing on how stupid a lot of the parts of that regime was, that for me makes me feel stronger around the image of them and the way I think about them. And focusing on how stupid their uniforms were, you know, the fact that, you know, the uniforms looked like they were designed by 11-year-old boys. You look at every part of all the insignia on their hats, they had a skull and crossbones. And then on their belts, they had lightning bolts, and they had eagles on their shirts and wolves. And when you look at all those things combined, you think, oh, they just wanted to be cool. They just that's what they wanted. They wanted people to fear them. But when you look at all those things, it's ridiculous. I mean, they kind of thought themselves as sort of Viking pirates. Yeah, and if you look at Hitler and you can take away all of these things, all that power by focusing on the fact that he looked like an idiot with that stupid moustache and his silly hats and his big hipped pants and his tight boots. And when you step back and look at him, he looked like a clown. And I like doing that. I like kind of taking the power back from these people because they're just humans. And it's not just one Nazi that the world should be afraid of. The fact that, you know, they were so effective is because there were enough of them. Enough of them got brainwashed and enough of them believed in this ridiculous idea. And that's where the fear that comes from. It's the fact that an entire country can be swept away in this frenzy and this groupthink.
Is this something that you feeling, say, in New Zealand as well? That kind of groupthink? Is that happening?
Not so much. New Zealand, you know, it's a wonderful place. It's more any racism that's there that we experience in New Zealand, and I'm just coming from, like, my background is indigenous, so Māori on my father's side, and on my mother's side, the origins are Russian Jews. And the Jewish communities, when I was growing up, you know, it was quite small. And so, but I don't think growing up in the 80s, many kids even knew what a Jew was. So I didn't really experience anything on that side. But mainly because I'm brown, it would be racism towards Polynesians and brown people. And it's definitely there, but it's not like masses of people. There aren't that many. Like, I think New Zealand is still a place where if a group of people got together and tried to do that, most people in New Zealand would crush them.
There was this, I guess, these really striking scenes for me after the Christchurch massacre of seeing all these young people do Maori dances. And these images were kind of transmitted all the world. And they felt like something I would never see here in the U.S., people kind of taking this great pride in indigenous culture, even people who weren't Maori, evidently.
Yeah, and it was actually every culture and a lot of other religions coming to support the Muslim community after that tragedy. And it was not only Maori, but many people from different factions and different parts of society and different religions would come down to the mosques in the weeks following and stand vigil and stand guard around the mosques. You know, you had Christians, everyone, and including Polynesians as well. And it was it was great to see that something that was designed and an act that was designed to break us, to pull us apart, actually unified the country in a really, really amazing way. And that actually created a huge amount of love and understanding. And I was really proud of my country at that point.
I want to speak about a couple of your other movies. What was the experience like trying to get financial support in New Zealand for movies about Indigenous people?
I can't speak for other people, but it was easy for me because I'm New Zealand's golden boy of cinema. And, well, there are definitely struggles in trying to make films in New Zealand, but women have it the hardest. And female directors in New Zealand have, you know, just like anywhere else, have got are fighting the biggest fight to get their films made and their stories made. We do make a decent amount of stuff that deals with the Indigenous experience. I had it a little easier than most because the very first short film I made, which was about was set in an indigenous community where I'm from, about some kids waiting for their parents in a car outside a pub. It's called Two Cars, One Night. And that was my first film, and it got nominated for an Oscar. And then after that, they basically let me do whatever I wanted. So I got to make those films that I wanted, my feature films, and they pretty much left me alone. And not in a way where, like, you know, the danger is you get too many yes people around you, you know, and you say, they say yes to any idea you have. I still have a community of people that I work with and peers and creative people who will challenge me, you know, and but it's more that the people who pay for the movies, which is the New Zealand Film Commission, were, I guess, supportive enough of me and knowing that my sort of my process could be trusted, that they would just give me the money and let me do it.
How does the fact that there is a big audience for these kinds of stories you've made in New Zealand square with the way that the history of colonization is actually taught in New Zealand?
There's a big drive growing up in New Zealand for educators to teach kids about what happened, about New Zealand's history. There's nothing that's really brushed over. It used to be the case that the colonial system wasn't really interested in people learning about what they'd done or what they'd stolen. But now it's very you can't avoid it in schools. And for me, growing up in, you know, in the 80s and 90s, everyone knew about it, and it was something you studied. And it was it's information that's very readily available, and it's always and it's often readily shared between people. So most people would grow up having some idea about the treaty that our current system and New Zealand as we know it was founded on, and the discrepancies between two versions of the treaty, and how it is a legally binding document, but there are still a lot of things that haven't been honoured within that document, which means that the Māori have had the short end of the stick, and we've lost a lot of land and lost a lot of rights over the years. You know, each government that comes in is trying to rectify that and trying to make amends, some better than others. But yeah, it's something you're very aware of, and no one hides it in New Zealand.
You went from a very small budget film like What We Do in the Shadows to, within 2 or 3 years, you're making Thor Ragnarok, which is like more than 100 times as big a budget, right? What was that transition like, going from something so small and intimate and quirky to a huge film that was also quirky in many ways, but was it just like a system that you're worried you get eaten alive by?
For about 5 minutes, I thought, this is going to be such a shock to my system, and how am I going to make that transition? But then I realized that there must have been a reason for them choosing me to do this film. And I know it's not because of my experience in superhero movies or action films. It's because of the way I see the world and the characters that I create and the stories that I tell. And that's a very unique style and a unique way of telling stories. And that's what Marvel, to their credit, often do with the directors that they bring in. They're usually people who don't necessarily need to have had any experience. You know, the Russo brothers had done Community when they came in. I mean, they were comedy directors. And, you know, now they've done Endgame and Civil War, which was something you never would have expected, which is not to say that, you know, no one believed that they could do it. It's just something that, so what's great about what Marvel are doing is that they're just defying expectations all the time. And I think that's what happened with me. They brought me in and gave me the tools to make this film. And I felt comfortable knowing that, because my one was like maybe the 18th film or 17th film that they'd made, that they knew what they were doing. I knew what I was doing with the things that I'd come in to do. And I think that, you know, I felt like, okay, well, it's going to be a good collaboration, and I'm here to support them, and, you know, with their franchise, and they're very much there to support these filmmakers that they bring in. For me, the big difference is really just time. It just takes a lot more time to do stuff, because, and even just simply on set takes a long time, because there's another, you know, 300 more people involved than what I would have on my films. And yeah, and the food is better sometimes. But craft services. Outside of that, it's the exact same process. When I'm working, everything around, all those hundreds of people in the periphery and behind me, they all disappear. And it's all about just recreating human moments that are hopefully believable within a rectangle. And you have actors, and it doesn't matter if they're on a film that costs $100,000 or a film that costs $150,000. They're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to be believable and remember their lines and say the lines fast. And as a director, you're just trying to give them the space to achieve that. Sometimes the lines are different and they're talking about these weird mythological things and, you know, and powers and all this sort of stuff. And other times they're talking about growing up in a native community in New Zealand and, you know, and where they're going to get money to buy a, you know, a pack of cigarettes. But the intention is always there and everyone has that same intention. Creating some truth on screen and telling a damn good story.
We have to wrap up, but I do want to ask one last question. You're planning on shooting the next Thor movie in Australia, which has obviously been experiencing these massive wildfires. Do you think filmmakers need to take climate change into account more, both in terms of where you're shooting, but also in terms of subject matter?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think, you know, like not every film dealing with World War II has to take you to a camp. You know, definitely can't be forgotten and needs to be addressed. But, you know, and I appreciate films that deal with things like climate change. This film deals with a lot of things. And it's the thing about these scripts is they are constantly changing. And also, it's quite, what's fun about doing these films is you get to sort of seed in these ideas and things that you don't want them to be too obvious or too on the nose. But, you know, the Indigenous experience was something that we subtly would put into the last Thor film. And I think what's really important for every film crew going anywhere in the world is to identify, acknowledge, thank, and also try to involve local tribes, whoever the Indigenous presence are in that area where you're shooting. I think it's vital, and I think it's just plain politeness just to actually find those people and say, hey, we have the intention of shooting here on your ancestral grounds. You know, can you please welcome us in your traditional way? And that's what I do on all my films, is get the local Indigenous people to come and do that. And we had a welcome to country ceremony on Thor Ragnarok in Australia with the Yugambi tribe, and it just opens up the whole thing in a really beautiful, peaceful way. And when everyone comes in with good intentions, and then just good things happen. You know, it sets you up for success. You got to do it.
Taika Waititi is the writer, director, and star of Jojo Rabbit. Taika, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. Cheers.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.